also is a circuit that drives the power production. So I'm not so sure if double confirmation is one symptom or perceived symptom driving another characteristic. So I'd have to think about that. But in any case, I will I'll definitely report back. And I think, as I said, step one is the bird. I'm not looking forward to opening that coax again because the junction up by the feed point, I've got some LMR 400, I got 50 feet of LMR 400 going from the antenna to the radio, and it's got rubber tape, you know, the stretchy 3M stuff. I took a couple of beads of silicone, three beads of silicone down the length of it, and squished that under more rubber tape, and it's taped up really, really well. It's going to be darn unfun to undo that if I have to do it for soldering purposes, but we'll see. Worst case is, after the rain stops tomorrow, I'll go do it. I've got a T20 antenna to install also, so I might as well just make them one happy trip up the tower. TQIW, thank you, sir. And have a happy new year. And by the way, I have the ability to compare a 756 Pro 3 and two 746 Pros, which is very interesting. I'm not sure with a position of a roofing filter, you'd be able to tell the difference between the two radios without looking at the front panel. Anyway, T20W, WT2TTT.
Yeah, where that roofing filter will really shine is if you were in a contest operation with a lot of very strong signals nearby. That's where the roofing filter, I think, does the most amount of work. And so, unfortunately, when you're running a test like this, Murphy's Law dictates that there's very few signals on the band. You're there all by yourself. Find one other guy to talk to. And therefore, you don't get a chance to run a full test. And to do a laboratory test of that would require ways of mixing signals together so that 10 or 20 kc away, you can check a real strong signal. At the same time, you're putting in a weak signal that you're tuned to and find out what the receiver threshold is like. Okay, good luck with your bird watt meter. And by the way, when it comes to weatherproofing connectors, some people, when it comes to the type N connector that's at the end of a cable, right at the antenna itself, where it joins the semi-rigid coax, I guess a bead of plastic adhesive there to make sure that water doesn't crawl down that region 58 flange connector is one thing to worry about. Second of all, some people will put a huge ball of tape around the connector to weatherproof it. I'm not convinced that's the right way to go. If the connector itself is well installed, not a crimp connector, it's got a built-in washer that does a medium good job of weatherproofing, and then the tape you add afterwards is sort of belt and suspenders. But if you do a poor job of putting on the tape, you can hurt more than you help. The biggest thing you got to worry about is make sure there is absolutely no entrapped air, because any air in the wrapping will be expanding and contracting as you get through from a hot to a cold day, and that will be drawing in water. So where you've got a notch at the back of the connector and you're about to wrap some tape there, my suggestion is to put either coax seal or duct seal in that gap area so you get a smooth triangular transition, a conic transition from one diameter of the connector down to the smaller diameter of the cable, and then wrap tape on top of that. So with the coax seal or the duct seal in that normal space where you would have an air gap, well done, you end up with no air gap, and it doesn't require more than one layer of tape in my opinion, and therefore taking it apart later on is not as difficult. I've done all my connectors on top of the tower that way, and I think I've been moderately successful. Good luck with that whole operation, Bob. And I mean, Gordon, and have a new year. Have a nice new year. Marvin, I hope you're still there, because I know you were also mobile. KC2, Golf Zulu Charlie, mobile. K2LIW, the tech net. You got it, Marvin.
Thanks, sir. Good evening, gentlemen. I just only had one comment, and I'd like to say it's been a pleasure always listening to the tech net. Very informative, very enlightening, and I've never worked 6 meters, just primarily 2 meters and 440. Just my comment. Enjoy the tech net very much. Brought me to my destination this evening, I'd like to say 7-3, and Happy New Year. I look forward to hearing more from you next year.
Very fine, Marvin. I bet you're also going to a party. Well, the smart people are going to parties tonight, and here I am sitting here talking to these guys going to parties. Something's wrong with this picture. But my wife and I will sit in front of the television set, watch the ball fall, drink a small glass of champagne. Actually, we drink it looks like champagne, but it's not. Clear grape juice. Something we fell in love with. I'm not an alcohol consumer on most occasions. Okay, anyone else want to add their questions, comments, or whatever to the TechNet? Give me your call letters right now. M-Name, KQRIW.
Jake, one further comment, WPCCC.
Go ahead, Gordon.
Yeah, I just take heart. I didn't answer your question directly, your statement. I'm out driving home to Newark Airport and now back home with my son James, who just got in from Texas. He was at the Order of the Arrow National Planning Meeting for the section chief. So he had a wonderful time, and we're a few blocks from home. So I'm going to, bid you adieu, and we'll be probably doing something similar to what you and your wife are doing in my house, too. Although I think the newly arrived, or about to be newly arrived home, and maybe his second brother will be out. The third one, he's staying home. Anyway, 73 K2IW, Happy New Year, WTTT, and thanks.
Very fine, Gordon. Congratulations. Sounds like your son had a good time. A good buddy of mine, WA5VJB, lives in Dallas, Texas, and he tells me that there are some counties in Texas where you can still use as a legal defense the native killing. That state is something else. Good luck. Have a nice new year. KQIW listening.
KF2XW.
KX2FW. You may have to give that to me phonetically.
Excuse me?
And give us your name, too. My name is Dick.
Dick, I just want to wish you a happy new year real quick. This is KCKEY, I've been operating the great T-Night. QRIW, K2KE1.
K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, I didn't think you'd be around tonight. I was operating the straight T night. a lot of excitement this year with the straight T. I think they've drummed up quite a number of stations. So I just wanted to wish you a happy new year, and best to you and Charlie and the kids and everything like that. Got that very nice letter, and I guess that brings me up to speed on what's going on there, over.
Pretty fine. Your cat is K1CAT, or what? Oh, is your cat's name Ring Meow? What's his name?
We call her MC. We don't have names that originally my cat, and so we call her MC, but I gave her the nickname K2CAT, CW only. She only operates CW. Sounds like she's sending CW just to me just a second ago. So that's why we call her K2CAT, over.
Well done. Good sense of humor. Glad you got that letter. Russ, try one more time. KF2 X-ray W, K2RIW in the tech net.
Okay. I want to put up a 160-meter loop. What is the minimum amount of wire you think you can get away with without using a good tuner?
Oh, got the loop man right here. Mel, tell him how much wire he needs. I think your loop was intended for 80 meters, 160 meter loop without a bunch of loading coils. I bet you need a fairly big piece of property. K2KEY, go right ahead.
Okay, good evening, all. This is K2KEY. Yeah, well, my loop is 272 feet and in circumference. So, for 160, you're going to have to double it. And so you need a bit of real estate. I was just on, in fact, just 10 minutes ago. So I came down here to see what's doing. And I was just on 80 meters with the straight K9. And used the loop antenna, and well, I'll tell you what else I'm doing. A little problem with 80 meters, the noise level has been pretty heavy the last few weeks because of the holidays with all these little flashing lights and things, so I have to do some little bit modification to the receiving system. So, do you have the real estate there? Over.
I have 100 by 100 watts. So, people were telling me like 265 feet, you know, definitely over 200. But you're telling me that's completely wrong? You're talking doubling that? Well, I'm going to make a quick comment on that one. The 272 is what he's using for a loop on 80 meters. It implies you need almost twice that, 544 feet on 160. And if you had a square piece of property, that would be 136 by 136 piece of property, rough numbers. Now, I'll bet you, though, the loop doesn't have to be completely square. I'll bet you could do some zigzagging. I wonder, Mel, if you know anyone who has ever built a loop with zigzags in order to make the electrical length longer when you don't have a big enough piece of property. K2KUY, K2IW on the tech then.
Yeah, most definitely. You can put up a delta loop. You can zigzag it like Joey said. It doesn't have to be the classic way it shows it in the magazine that shows four nice posts equally spaced and all. The only problem that you will run into, Russ, is in the way you use the tuna. A dallum don't seem to work out quite well. So in most cases, you either have to build yourself combination of two L networks, basically using two rotary inductors and a differential variable capacitor. Or you could buy one of these tuners that are quite expensive that they've come out on the market. I believe MFJ has come out with one, a bit on the pricey side. I am using a old Johnson kilowatt matchbox, which uses wing coupling. So, that's the only pitch with the loops that I have run into, that type of tuna is a bit of a problem. Not a real major problem, but it seems that all the serious loop people out there are basically doing it similar to what I'm doing, using 600 ohm open wire meters. And again, my loop is not symmetrical, far from being symmetrical. But it does encompass 272 feet of wire. Back to you, Russ.
Okay. Well, I have a pretty decent tuner. I have a Palstar tuner, and I can tune my G5RV up on 160 meters. You know, it's not the best, but it's a 102 foot G5RV, and it does that. You know, I can use it for the immediate area. It's not too bad, but very touchy. So I just wanted to get something up there a little bit longer. And one of the things you ought to know about, Russ, that Mel has discovered is that by using a pair of independent L networks and going through all the possible tunings, he can adjust the amount of power he's putting into his 600 ohm open wire line. He can independently adjust differential versus common mode. By differential, I mean if you put plus 1 volt on the right-hand side of the 600 ohm wire and minus 1 volt on the left-hand side, so to speak, you'd be feeding it differentially. If you put plus 1 volt on the right side and plus 1 volt at the left side, you would be feeding it common mode. Well, Mel has discovered that when he slowly shifts by independently tuning the L network on the left side and the L network on the right side, he can slowly slide from differential mode to common mode, and somewhere in between is where he gets the best performance in many of the directions. Let me turn it over to Mel to give you more information on that. Go ahead, Mel.
Yeah, Roger. You hit it right on the nail on the head, as they say, Dick. We did a lot of experimenting and a lot of discussions on this process. And basically what Dick said is exactly what happened. If you measure the current in either one of the feeders, you find that as you swing through it, the SWR, at the minimum SWR, you would think that that would be the best signal that you would either be receiving or transmitting to another station. And it winds up that that is not the case. I've made many, many tests with the X stations and other stations here in the United States at different distances and all. And many times when the SWR, if I swing, in other words, to a point where the SWR will be, or I should say the current of one leg would be higher than the other, many times they confirmed that my signal was stronger. So it didn't necessarily work out that the minimum SWR at that point was the best optimum performance of the loop. So to compensate for that, by using two separate L networks, they're able to balance that out. In fact, the VL network, you put the vallum on the input of the L network. In other words, you got the transmitter, the vallum, and then the L network, butterfly type of condenser, Russ, over.
Somehow I knew that my question was just going to be... I knew I couldn't, no one could come up with an answer for me, really, you know, how much wired. So I knew it was going to be more complicated than what I was looking for, but that's just the way it is. Yeah, it turns out that almost anything you want to do in life, lots of people say keep it simple. That's a nice philosophy. But almost everything you do where you dig in deep and make it work well and squeeze all you can out of it, if you think the problem is simple, you probably don't understand the problem. Very few things are really simple. I have a lot of fun asking my friends I work with, give me an example of something that mankind has studied, we understand it very well, and it's simple. And you ask your friends that, and if they're being truthful with you, it's a very difficult question to answer. So, Mel and I have had lots of discussions over the last year or so about what's really going on with that antenna. When you feed it in the pure common mode, same voltage on each side, you're using it as the loop is a kind of a capacitive top hat to a kind of a ground plane antenna. When you feed it differential, yes, it is a horizontal loop, in theory, should be sort of like the vertical stacking of a pair of dipoles you would have with a cubical quad, except that it's laying on its side. That's one way of looking at it. A omnidirectional loop antenna, which is used in the broadcast industry, is usually made by making the loop very small compared to a wavelength. That way the current around the loop is equal in each segment, or very close to equal, and you end up with an omnidirectional pattern. But a very high Q antenna, that's a little bit critical to tune, kind of narrow band. Well, the loops that amateurs put up are really none of those. And so what's really going on is not clear. It's probably a beautiful situation where some of the better computer modeling programs can really tell you what's going on. I'll bet you, of all the articles you've read on the subject, Mel, I bet you each one of the guys who has tried various ways of feeding various diameter loops, I bet they all express a little bit of mystery as not knowing why certain combinations work so well. That's my guess. You can
or deny that one, Mel. K2KEY, K2IW in the segment.
This is K2KEY. You're right, Dick. If you want a variety of ideas on the same subject, it's amazing. They've done everything conceivable, bent and twisted, and these loop-to-loop. In other words, at the corners, one guy says he came up with an answer to a lot of the problems of loop. He adds these looping wires. In other words, he comes along with a loop. He puts an insulator, fairly large insulator, I think it's been around 10 inches, piece of insulating material, and then loops the wire down and back up again. Now, what the heck is that supposed to be doing? I don't know. Is that acting something like, I guess, theoretically, is he making a capacity out of some sort? Over.
Well, from what you described, if the wire going down and coming back up is relatively close together, it is another piece of 600 ohm transmission line with a short at the bottom. And as long as less than a quarter wavelength long, that is an inductive stub, a series inductive stub. So with that technique, of putting a coil of wire, a loading coil, so to speak, at strategic locations in the loop. And in my opinion, that's a good way of mechanically shrinking down the loop and yet electronically keeping it the same length. So my best guess is that's a series inductive stub. And with your Smith chart or by calculation, you can calculate how many millihenry or nanohenry or microhenry it's making. And it's a kind of high-power loading coil, which can take a zillion watts without arcing over or doing anything bad. Just simple pieces of wire up in the air. You would think it's a simple antenna. Well, radiation is not simple. You have to kick that wave in the tail of that RF energy. You have to kick it in the tail quite a few times before it finally jumps off that wire. But the signal is bouncing back and forth on the dipole probably about 30 times. When you make the dipole the right length, all of those 30 bounces, they co-phase. Therefore, you get maximum current and maximum radiation. Make the dipole a little bit short or a little bit long, it acts like a capacitor or an inductor on the first time the RF energy crawled along the dipole. If that was true, the length of the dipole would be very non-critical. There'd only be an extremely minor variation when you change the length, and that ain't true. You make a minor change to the length of your dipole, and your standing wave ratio meter will tell you real fast that something not so great is happening. Now back to you, Mel, for some comments on this before you pass it back to Russ. K2IW in the tech map.
Yep, this is K2KEY. Well, the little extra loop that they add, Dick, claims that it makes it more broadband a loop, and at the same time, it makes it so that it will work on other bands. I guess because the harmonic relationship to some extent from band to band of HF, maybe by putting the, I don't know if you can call them a stub. I guess you can call them some kind of a stub. He claims that, he says that he referred to them, I believe, as a type of capacity hat that he adds to the loops. And he says the loop that he says that this has made it more evenly tunable across the entire 80-meter band, which is, you know, quite large, 500 kilohertz. And he says at the same time he's able to take this, well, this has to be a 160 meter loop that he was using on 80, and he says with this system, he can get it to work on 40 meters and 30 meters and whatever. So I can say every time I speak to somebody who's running a loop, I hear another idea, another story, another guy has something else to talk about, you know, of doing something with a loop. So it has opened up in the last couple of years a whole new world of antennas, it seems, from something that was around for an awful long time but became very dormant some years ago when, of course, you know, when
you know, something starts on the air, like they basically started to claim that the loop was strictly, you know, a cloud warmer, and so it fell on hard times, as they say, but it's been disproven very much lately, Dick, over.
Scott, when you put those stubs or those loops in the corners that you're talking about, at 160 meters or 80 meters, the basic frequency where you're doing it, I think the stub is much longer, much shorter than a quarter wave, and it's the shortest at the far end, therefore it is an inductive stub. When you go to the higher frequencies, that same length of loop is a greater number of wavelengths, and so at certain frequencies it could start flipping over to be a capacitive stub. When you go beyond quarter wavelengths and a short at one end, it becomes a capacitor instead of an inductor. So you can have a grand old time with that. Let me hit you with something else, Russ, that will blow your mind, and maybe Mel hasn't heard this either, and that is the dipole antenna, the Hertzian dipole, has been around since the late 1800s. So we've got 110 or so years, maybe 115 years, into that most basic antenna type. With 115 years of use of a dipole, anybody with common sense would say, my goodness, we have built millions of them by hundreds of thousands of ham radio operators, laboratory technicians, engineers, scientists, whatever. By now, we must really know that antenna. You go to the Antenna Engineering Handbook, you go to Chapter 4, and you'll see a whole bunch of charts and graphs for every reasonable diameter of monopole, which is half of a dipole, every reasonable diameter and every reasonable length of monopole. The reactive component and the resistive component is very nicely plotted. We've got lots of data. Okay. Over the last month, because of a need I've got for a particular client of mine, I do electrical engineering consulting. I need a dipole-like antenna that is more broadband. And the 80-meter band is the worst band in the world. If you decide that the center frequency is 3.75 megs, and that band is 500 kcy, mathematically you would say it's 13 1/3% wide. Well, the dipole gives you pretty nice performance over maybe 2 or 3% of the band, but a 13 1/3% band, your dipole is going to be pretty wild at the frequency extremes in its standing wave ratio. So I've been doing research as to who has found ways of broadbanding a dipole. You go to the appropriate chapter of the ARRL antenna book, and you'll see a whole lot of techniques for broadbanding at a dipole. And some of those techniques will give you maybe a 50% or a 70% increase in the VSWR bandwidth of a dipole with reasonably equal radiation performance. And I thought for a while that's all there was. Here we are with the brand new issue of the IEEE Antennas and Propagation magazine or journal. The December issue 2006 has a brand new article on how to broadband a dipole. And this guy has managed to make the 2-to-1 VSWR bandwidth of a dipole. He has taken an ordinary dipole, measured its VSWR bandwidth, added his extra technique, and he has not increased it by 30%. He has increased it by 300%. He has tripled the bandwidth of a dipole. He has also extended the technique and gone a little bit further where he can make the dipole simultaneously resonate on two separate desired chosen frequencies. Beautiful article. And you look at that thing and you say, what in the world has the guy done? At first you would say, he made the dipole into a three-element Yagi. He's got two parasitic elements, one in front of the dipole and one in the back of the dipole. At first you would say, gee, one looks like a director and one looks like a reflector. And you study it a little bit more and you suddenly realize both of these parasitic elements are the identical length. Ordinarily you'd make the reflector longer and the director shorter and you would end up with a signal squirting in one direction. You'd have directivity. He's made both of them shorter. He's made them with very close coupling. He made them at just the right length, and it is a kind of a three-element EID. Is identical to a dipole. It has no directivity at all. So two parasitic elements manages to triple the bandwidth. So here we are, 120 years later, you think you know everything about a dipole. Uh-uh. There's much more brand new things to be discovered. I was amazed by that. Over to you, Russ. I know we're a little bit off the subject of your loop antenna. The loop antenna is even more elaborate than a dipole, and here we are, 120 years later, making all these breakthroughs in the most basic, simple antenna in the world, a dipole. To me, that's kind of exciting. KF2XW, K2LIW in the TechNet. Okay, KF2XW, well, that actually brings me to my next question. I have I've heard you say a lot that, you know, the dipole has not changed much over 100 years, and I have a 1995 copy of the antenna handbook when I first got licensed. And is it worth buying a new copy of that to study, or do you think things are pretty much the same? When it comes to the information that's in the ARRO antenna book, the sections on broadbanding a dipole, I don't think those sections have changed very much in the last few years. So you're not. I'm not recommending you buy a brand new book because that particular section has been recently updated. What I am saying is that the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers has a separate special technical group, which is called the Antennas and Propagation Society, of which I'm a member for the last 30, 35 years, and their monthly journal, the December issue, 2006, has this article on super broadbanding of a dipole. Beautiful article. So if you go to a good technical library, you will be able to find the Antennas and Propagation Journal. Going to a library is the best way, but it's a darn good article. I will warn you that the article with the super broadbanding, where he has tripled the bandwidth of a dipole, is a printed circuit technique, and he's doing it at exactly 1,000 megacycles to prove the principle. Not because there's any particular magic radio service at 1,000 meg. Just that by doing it at 1,000 meg, you and I can easily scale it to any other frequency we want. He did it at a nice round number, 1,000 meg. And he did it with printed circuit. It is my belief that a similar technique with dipoles made out of wire in air can be made to work. It is my belief. Even though he did it as a printed circuit, he was doing it as a printed circuit that had no ground plane. He just did it as a printed circuit as a simple technique for fabricating the three conductors in question. The middle one is driven, the other two with extremely close spacing and carefully chosen length are parasitic elements. So maybe that partially answers your question, Rod. KF2XW, K2IW in the TechNet.
Okay. Well, I thank you for the information. It told me what I pretty much know already, that by coming on here and asking you a question and taking the lazy approach first, now I have to go do some work. But, you know, it was worth a shot. All right. Thank you very much, and I'll be here listening for the rest of the net, and have a happy new year. KF2XW.
Okay. Good DX in the new year. Now, back to you, Mel. Mel, you're going to want to see that article. So by hook or by crook, if you have any trouble getting it, I'll burn you a copy and mail it to you. You got to see that December issue. I will warn you that two-thirds of the articles in the Antennas and Propagation Society Journal have great big long titles where the title is a paragraph of words, only some of which you understand, you and I will understand. The journal tends to be a bit on the technical side. This particular article is mildly technical, but I'm willing to plow through it because he's offering something that looks awful valuable to me. Considering the previous broadbanding techniques I know about, this guy has found a 99% efficient, no change in the antenna radiation pattern, but he has tripled the bandwidth, and if you extend this technique even further,
it develops a U-shaped curve of VISWA versus frequency, where it's got two humps of very good VISWA. So you can either use it as a broadbanding technique, or you can use it as a dual frequency technique, where you have got complete choice of the two frequencies you want the dipole to resonate on. And so I'm amazed that 120 years downrange, we're making breakthroughs on how to tune a dipole. KQKEY, KQIW in the tech net.
W2VL, repeater system.
You know, Zach, it wouldn't surprise me if this KQKEY, because here we are. You talk about a dipole being old. Look at the loop antenna, the original experiment that I believe it was Tesla did, remember, with the loop by applying energy, a spark, to one loop and having another loop in the laboratory that was the exact size with the just an open gap. He was able to make an arc, to actually, when he made spark on loop A, it sparked on loop B. So, nothing would surprise me because maybe we'll even see somebody reinvent the wheel. I guess the old cliche, the only thing that's sane is death and taxes. I guess everything else is scientific or whatever else in this world is subject to discussion and to maybe change or modification or improvement. Dick, on the subject, do you ever have had any experience with receiving loop, the HF, receiving, not transmitting, I bet? I guess they have worked with some transmitting loops on HF, but how about a receiving loop? And then I'll tell you an experiment I just completed, over.
Yeah, I'm going to backtrack on what I just said. I was saying that the most basic antenna is a dipole. You're absolutely right. The original experiment by all kinds of guys, I think, I can't remember his name, Franklin? Could have been Franklin. Hertz, could have been quite a few guys who were doing extremely early experiments with radio. Might have even been Marconi. The very first transmission through air was, like you said, loop A and loop B. And you could tell the reception by the spark on the second loop, even though you're creating a spark intentionally on the first one. And boy, you talk about insensitive receiver. If your receiver has to create a spark that jumps the gap, and I believe the rough rule of thumb is no matter how close the gap is in air, you have to have a minimum of 200 volts before you can jump that gap. In other words, their receiver was so insensitive that until 200 volts occurred at the antenna, until you had 200 volts at the antenna, you didn't have reception. Think about the fact that nowadays we build radio receivers with a quarter and an eighth of a microvolt of sensitivity. And in the beginning, you needed 200 volts of sensitivity. I think we're talking about 300 decibels of difference. I'm going to do that calculation on your next transmission as to how many decibels of difference is between a modern receiver at a quarter of a microvolt versus the old receiver at 200 volts. Wow. I'm trying to remember what your question was now, but without a doubt is you can look at it two ways. The Russians have an expression, nothing new under the moon, and you and I would say nothing new under the sun. Everything is just a rehash. That's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is you think you understand it, there's really more to it. A simple dipole with a couple of very simple parasitic elements. Who in the world would have ever thought of building a three-element Yagi where the director and the reflector are both the exact same length? By the same token, way back in 1947, I had a crystal set. I had a Galena crystal, and I owned a pair of cat whiskers. If I had been smart enough to plug in both cat whiskers at the same time and put a battery across them, in theory,
I could have made a transistor. So just a simple crystal detector. Look at the fact that the very first radios were solid state. Later on, we started using tubes. Nowadays, we've gotten smarter. We've gone back to solid state. You could say everything is always changing. Well, there's nothing new under the moon. Both attitudes are correct. More to it than first meet the eye. K2KUI. Drag your feet in case anyone wants to join us. K2LIW in the tech net.
Say what I'm saying.
Fred recognized. Fred, give us a couple words.
Already know.
Somebody else had a comment, too? Yeah, right. You're talking about the closely spaced, but I'm kind of curious as to what was the ratio. I thought I had a really clever antenna design until I realized that part of it was an artifact, although part of it may have been correct. I know when you use these modeling programs and you have closely spaced conductors, the program can get fooled, and I found a really easy way to fool one. Start off with an 80-meter dipole, for example, and in free space, and you have a piece of, like, 70 ohms or something. You place very close to it a wire half as long, centered on the same thing. And when you get the distance right, you will now, in the computer program, I haven't tried this in real life, so you may have a better program that would actually see this. You can get 50 ohms, and the interesting thing is that if you then feed in at the double the frequency, you will also see 50 ohms. And it will appear to be a dipole for 40 meters. I don't know, maybe this is something old hat to you, and this is my question, which came up when you were talking about the closely spaced wires on a dipole. Back to you, Dick.
Pretty fine, Fred. It's possible the computer program was telling you the truth. Now, I, for one, have made extremely little use of computer modeling programs on antennas. Most of the people who know that the majority of my consulting for the last 6 years has been on the subject of antennas, and I filed a few patents on the subject. So therefore, you would assume that the modern technique is computer modeling. I claim to be a modern antenna designer, inventor, whatever, and therefore you would think I use modeling programs. And for a bunch of reasons, I do not. One, I'm not a very good computer hacker. I'm a little bit more of a hands-on person. Second of all, the best work on antennas I've ever done is by the Edisonian approach, the lots of elbow grease approach. The so-called LIW-19 Yagi was derived in my backyard with 150 hours of careful tuning of a long 432 Yagi using a ratiometry antenna range. That's the one that's in the February issue of 1976 QST magazine. With a ratiometry type antenna range, I could easily resolve 0.05 decibels of gain change, a 20th of a dB of gain resolution. So it was like a blind man walking up a hill. I could tune each individual element, and I knew when I was going in the right direction when the gain was increasing. Okay, that's what I was doing in 1978. Here I am in the year 2003, developing a Yagi, and the Yagi I developed for a particular client in that year was made with the elements extremely fat and made out of printed circuit. The elements were, I forget now what the percentage, I think they were 12% of a wavelength-wide sheet metal element. Three-element Yagi, with some one simple stamping of sheet metal, and then it was bent into a slightly exotic shape. It had the balun built into the Yagi. It had extremely strong gain in one direction, good front-to-back ratio, and 3% bandwidth
where my definition of bandwidth is the frequencies of over which it is well under 1.2 standing wave ratio. So the combination of very wide sheet metal elements was devised by the Edisonian approach, the modern day equivalent. I was doing it with wide pieces of copper tape on a piece of printed circuit board without a ground plane, and watching the results on a modern day network analyzer antenna range. The network analyzer was displaying gain in the color of blue and standing wave ratio in the color of yellow on this color display of a modern Rohde & Schwarz network analyzer. I was looking at standing wave ratio, in other words, S11, and I'm looking at gain, in other words, S21, simultaneously on an antenna range. And I'm standing off to one side with tuning tools at 915 megacycles doing this tuning. So when the gain went up and the VISWR went down, and when the bandwidth got broad and the gain got broad, when I was doing my tuning with little chunks of copper acting as a capacitor on the end of a long wooden stick, and I'm standing off to one side, I was doing, let me pick a number, 1,000 experiments in gain VISWR simultaneous, gain VISWR bandwidth, gain bandwidth. I was maximizing the gain, I was maximizing the gain bandwidth, I was minimizing the VISWR, and maximizing the VISWR minimum bandwidth all simultaneously. And by watching this on a real-time network analyzer, I could do 1,000 experiments in one day. The whole reason why people do computer modeling is because they think it saves them a lot of time. Well, you try to take any of the modern computer modeling programs and you try to model elements that are 13% of a wavelength wide, and it has to do finite element analysis. It's got to break the metallic object into a whole lot of tiny little triangles and calculate all the cross-coupling of all the triangles. That problem, on a supercomputer, you would get a couple of models per day. I was doing 1,000 experiments per day, and I could see when it was maximizing. So, in my opinion, for what I was seeking, I had a better approach than computer modeling. So, but still, the better computer modeling programs, when it comes to small diameter wires, some of them are very good. It could have been telling you the truth. To answer your original question, Fred, when you go to that article, you'll find out that the phony director and reflector, which are identical in length in this December 2006 article, those are all about 60% of the length of the dipole. They're very, very short, and the spacing is extremely close. In your 1,000 meg antenna, at 1,000 meg, the wavelength is a little bit less than 12 inches. It's 12.9 inches exactly at 915. So 1,000 meg, my guess is it was around a 12-inch wavelength, and he was making his elements, both the parasitic elements and the dipole themselves, out of copper strips that the, I'm scaling now from my memory of the photograph. I would say the copper strips were about a quarter inch wide and probably in the vicinity of 6 inches long for the dipole and about 3.5 inches long for the parasitic element. The spacing for those elements was a few thousandths of an inch. Very, very close spacing. And so, with common sense, you would have never gone there. I don't know if he arrived at that solution by way of computer modeling, or he had some other a priori knowledge. So, your modeling of what you saw as very broad bandwidth on your computer model, the super close spacing, I think there's a 90% chance, Fred, that you were skeptical, but your computer modeling program may have been telling you the truth. And when you go back and try it, you may get a very pleasant surprise, particularly if you study this article first. K1's Friendly Charlie, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, actually, of course, my model is that they're part of it. This is why I was a little suspicious. If they have been telling the truth on FWR, however, the reason I didn't go out and build one or tell everybody I had this great model was this. I looked at the 40-meter radiation pattern which was beautiful. It was just like a dipole, except that it had gauge. And the only way to interpret it was that because of the way the model handled the thing, it ended up with apparent radiation greater than what you were putting into it. And I figured that that would be with extreme skepticism of anybody saying you had an antenna to put out more than you were putting in. The SWR bit may have, in fact, had the matching, that may have been valid. And it was only the radiation that I knew it was cause of concern. It was back to UKLFC.
I think you should go back and revisit that, Mel. Even that may have been the truth. To my knowledge, many, if not most, of the computer modeling programs, when they rate gain, a rating gain with reference to isotropic, a full half-wavelength dipole does have 2.14 positive dB over isotropic. An infinitesimal long dipole is 1.76 dB, only 0.36 dB less. So if you're near the half-wave dipole with an extremely close parasitic element, had 2.14 dB of gain, that can be real with reference to ISO. In this article in the December issue, 2006, Antennas and Propagation Journal, he plotted the gain, measured the gain, and found 2.1 dB of gain over isotropic. Back to you, Fred.
Yeah, well, it could be, and I looked at it, and see, there's something wrong, and, the situation could be an artifact where you had an apparent gain that wasn't there, the interesting thing is that the radiation pattern on 40 meters would be as if all the radiation is occurring in the 40-meter section, and that the stuff that's sticking out, the wires at the end, aren't radiating anything. And that's in the model. And as I say, when I first looked at it, and I didn't think about, you know, the gain bit, but then when I realized that I had the identical radiation pattern of a 40-meter dipole, but it was showing more gain, it was like 60 dB over isotropic or something. I don't remember the numbers, but it was something where my feeling was, well, it should, if you've got the pattern of a 40-meter dipole, you should have the same gain as a 40-meter dipole. You follow KLFC?
I sure do, and I agree with you. If it had the exact same pattern in three-dimensional space as a 40-meter dipole, in other words, if you could see the complete pattern as an isotropic drawing, a dipole has a pattern that looks very similar to a donut in three-dimensional space. It's a slightly fat donut. And the hole in the center represents the lack of radiation off of the end of the dipole. And even if you add the drop-down wires on the end of the dipole, which technically are a kind of capacitive top hat, they have an extremely minor or almost no effect at all on the radiation pattern. So, yes, if I was in your shoes and I saw 6 dB over isotropic with dipole-like pattern, I also would have been very skeptical. But, so, many of these programs, I guess I've got some glitches where I know that almost all of the programs cannot properly handle multiple elements of extremely wide width or large diameter. I suspect that some of the programs have trouble when you get super close spacing, where the coupling coefficient to the parasitic element becomes very difficult to calculate. And I suspect that some of the programs do not properly represent the true resistivity of the materials in use. and so they can come up with super directivity answers, which may not be real. I mean, in theory, you could make a shielded radio.